This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity by Jamie Metzl, read by Eric Martin. Our life is a creation of our mind. Gautama Buddha. Introduction. Entering the Genetic Age. "Why are you here?" the young receptionist asked. It was my first visit to the New York Cryobank, and I was already feeling a bit uncomfortable. "I just think it's a good thing for most everyone to do," I said with a shrug. "I lecture around the world on the future of human reproduction and tell anyone who will listen who wants to have kids they should freeze their eggs or sperm when in their 20s. I'm just a little late." She raised an eyebrow. "About 20 years late?" "I don't understand. Are you a donor?"
"No."
"Are you going into chemotherapy or having some other medical treatment that could harm your sperm?"
"No."
"Are you in the military about to be deployed?"
"No."
"The only remaining category on my form is other," she concluded after an awkward pause. "Should I put you down for that?" Already feeling a bit precarious, I didn't want to go into the options I was mulling in my mind. Maybe I'll want to have children someday, so may as well store my younger sperm now. Maybe I'll volunteer my sperm to be sent into space when humans start colonizing the rest of the solar system. Maybe, as I believe, our species is moving toward a genetically altered future in which more of us will conceive our offspring in labs rather than in our beds or in the back seats of our cars. Whatever maybes might arise, starting now was the first step. "Well?" she asked. I smiled nervously, my mind processing the incredible moment in our evolutionary history where revolutionary new technologies and my own personal biology were intersecting in this antiseptic midtown Manhattan office. Scientists and theologians can debate whether the first spark of life on our planet sprang from thermal vents on the ocean floor or divine inspiration, or both, but most everyone who believes in science recognizes that around 3.8 billion years ago, the first single-cell organisms emerged. These microorganisms would have died after one generation if they couldn't find a way to reproduce, but life found a way. And the microbes that started dividing were the ones able to keep their little microbial families going. If each division of these early cells had been an exact copy of the parent, our world would still be occupied solely by these single-cell creatures, and you wouldn't be listening to this book. But that's not what happened. The history of our species is the story of little errors and other changes that kept popping up in the reproduction process. After a billion years of these small variations created a vast number of slightly different models, one or more of them transformed into simple multicellular organisms. Still not much by today's standards, these organisms had the potential to introduce even more differences as they reproduced. Some of these variations gave one type of organism or another a small advantage in acquiring food or fending off enemies, providing them the opportunity to live on and mutate more. After 2.5 billion years of this, the mutation and competition driving life forward took another miraculous leap with the advent of sexual reproduction. Sexual reproduction introduced a radical new way of generating diversity when the genetic information of mothers and fathers recombined in novel ways. This incredible process supercharged some of these simple organisms to begin mutating wildly, particularly by around 540 million years ago, into a previously unimaginable diversity of life, including fish. About 200 million years ago, some fish crawled out of the water and evolved into mammals. Around 300,000 years ago, some of those mammals morphed into Homo sapiens, aka us. That's basically our evolutionary history. Every one of us is a single-cell organism gone wild through nearly 4 billion years of random mutation, whose ancestors have continually outcompeted their competitors in a never-ending cage match for survival. If your ancestors survived and procreated, you are here. If not, you are not. The shorthand name for this is Darwinian evolution. It got us to this point. But now, the principles of Darwinian evolution are themselves mutating. From this point onward, much of our mutation will not be random. It will be self-designed. From this point onward, our selection will not be natural. It will be self-directed. From this point onward, our species will take active control of our evolutionary process by genetically altering our future offspring into something different from what we are today. We are, in other words, beginning a process of hacking Darwin. It is an incredible idea, with monumental implications. The current version of our Homo sapiens species was never an evolutionary endpoint, but always a stop along the way in our continuous evolutionary journey. Going forward, we will be driving this process like never before through our technology, hopefully guided by our best values. If we traveled 1,000 years into the past, kidnapped a baby, and brought that baby into our world today, that child would grow up into an adult indistinguishable from everyone else. But if we jumped back into the time machine and went 1,000 years from today into the future to do the same, the baby we brought back would be a genetic superhuman by our current standards. He or she would be stronger and smarter than the other children, resistant to many diseases, longer-lived, and have genetic traits today associated with outlier humans like particular forms of genius, or with animals like super-keen sensory perceptions. He or she might even carry new traits not yet known in the human or animal worlds, but made from the same biological building blocks that have given rise to the great diversity of all life. "Will the category other do?" the receptionist asked, cutting short my reverie. I took a deep breath. "That's probably the best bet." "Hmm," she murmured, appearing annoyed I seemed distracted. "And for how long would you like to store?" "Why don't I start with 100 years? Let's see how that goes." She eyed me suspiciously. "I'm sorry, sir, but our storage plans are for 1, 3, and 5 years. My facial expression betrayed my concern. That's a lot shorter than I was looking for. "You can always renew." "That's a lot of renewals," I said with a shrug. "How can I know you'll be around as long as I need?" "Don't worry, we'll be here. We just renovated our office." I gulped. Clearly, we were thinking differently about the future of reproduction. "Please have a seat and fill out these forms," she added, handing me a clipboard. "I'll call you when the doctor is ready." Sitting nervously in the stiff red plastic chair under the saccharine muzak of the white no-frills waiting room, I filled out the forms and reflected on how I'd arrived to this point. I thought back to the strange series of events that had made me absolutely obsessed with the genetic technologies that will change the evolutionary trajectory of every member of our species, including little old me. It began when I was working on the White House National Security Council in the second term of the Clinton administration. My then-boss and now close friend Richard Clark was telling anyone who would listen that terrorism was a major threat to U.S. security, and that the United States needed to much more aggressively go after an obscure terrorist named Osama bin Laden. When the 9/11 planes crashed into the Twin Towers, Dick's prophetic and now famous memo on Al-Qaeda was stuck, disregarded, in President Bush's inbox. Dick always used to say that if everyone in Washington was focusing on one thing, you could be sure there was something far more important being missed. The lesson stuck with me. After leaving the White House, I kept thinking about what were those critically important and under-addressed issues. My mind kept returning to the then-nascent revolution in genetics and biotechnology. I became consumed with reading everything I could find and tracking down some of the smartest scientists and thinkers in the world to learn more. When I felt I knew enough to have something to say, I started writing articles on the national security implications of the genetics revolution in foreign policy journals. One day in early 2008, I got a call out of the blue from a smart and eccentric congressman, Brad Sherman of California, then chairman of the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Nonproliferation, and Trade of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Congressman Sherman told me he'd been thinking a lot about the next generation of terrorist threats. He'd read and appreciated one of my articles and told me he wanted to hold a congressional hearing based on what I'd written. I was honored when he asked me to help frame the event, identify other potential participants, and serve as the lead witness for his prescient June 2008 hearing, Genetics and Other Human Modification Technologies. When our descendants 200 years from now look back at our present age and ask themselves what were the greatest foreign policy challenges of our time, I asserted in my testimony, I believe that terrorism, as critically important as it is, will not be on the top of their list. I am here testifying before you today because I believe that how we as Americans and as an international community deal with our new abilities to manage and manipulate our genetic makeup will be. The attention that came with the congressional testimony gave me confidence that I was on to something important, that I needed to dive deeper into this endlessly fascinating and rapidly changing topic, and that I had a message worth sharing. I wrote more and more in policy journals and began speaking around the country and world on the future of human genetic engineering. As I continued to learn and engage more, I became increasingly convinced we as a society weren't doing nearly enough to prepare for the coming genetic revolution, but worried my message was not getting through. Over time, I began to realize that to more effectively share my message, I needed to communicate differently. If my genetics policy lectures weren't breaking through, I needed to reach back into the toolkit I had used once before. After publishing my first book, an important but largely unread history of the Cambodian genocide filled with thousands of footnotes, I had realized the best vehicle for telling that tale was not a dense historical tome, but a story. Telling stories is what we've always done. The tales told in caves and around fires have only now morphed into our novels, movies, and television dramas. My second book, and first novel, The Depths of the Sea, explored the tragedy of Cambodian history, but this time through a series of intersecting stories of people drawn to the Thai-Cambodian border after the Vietnam War. The first book was a more accurate account of the Cambodian cataclysm, but the novel was far more digestible. So, when facing the challenge years later of trying to bring the critically important issues of the genetics revolution to life beyond my nonfiction writing and speaking, I reverted to my same strategy. In my science fiction novels, Genesis Code, which explores the implications of the genetics revolution, and Eternal Sonata, a speculation on the future of life extension, I tried to imagine what revolutionary genetic technologies will mean for us on a very human level. I tried to bring people into the story of our genetic future in ways they could more readily absorb. But then, an unexpected thing happened in my book tours. People at my events got a bit excited about the doomsday militias, conniving spymasters, budding romances, and flashbang explosions I'd concocted to give life to my sci-fi world. But their eyes opened widest when I explained the real science of the genetics revolution and what it seemed to mean for us human beings. When I explained the science using the language and storytelling of a novelist, audiences seemed to suddenly understand how the little snippets of scientific information they'd been encountering throughout their daily lives all fit together into the story of our future. I found myself discussing the fiction less and spending more time talking about the very real technology that had the potential to fundamentally transform our species. The animated conversations I had with people on book tours and at other events challenged me to learn more, and inspired me to ask myself even tougher questions about the future of human genetic engineering and my personal relationship to it. I arrived at my mid-40s without the children I always assumed I'd eventually have, in part because of my long-standing and not entirely rational faith in science, healthy living, and a positive attitude to check the ravages of time and cruelty of biology. I'm a technology optimist to my core, but as I conjured images of our world to come to my audiences, I found myself wondering if I really believed in the magic of technology as much as I professed. Did I really believe that the knowledge gained in 150 years of genetic science was enough to alter billions of years of our evolutionary biology? Would I really bet that genetic alterations helping make my future child healthier, smarter, and stronger would also make him or her happier? As a student of history, did I not bet that genetically enhanced people might use their advanced capabilities to dominate everyone else like colonial powers have always done? And, as the son of a refugee from Nazi Europe, was I really willing to accept the idea that parents could, and even should, start selecting and engineering their future children based on underinformed genetic theories? Whatever my answers, one thing was clear. After nearly 4 billion years of evolution by one set of rules, our species is about to begin evolving by another. In his far-sighted 1865 novel From the Earth to the Moon, French novelist Jules Verne described a 3-man crew launching themselves in a projectile to the moon and then parachuting home. In 1865, this was a pure work of fantastical science fiction. Very little of the technology that would eventually get humans to the moon a century later had been developed. Imagining a moon landing in 1865 was like imagining humans landing in a different solar system today. It might someday be possible, but we have no real clue how to do it. The science is just not there. A century later, in 1962, U.S. President John F. Kennedy ascended the podium in Houston to give his now-famous speech announcing that the United States would send a man to the moon by the end of the decade. President Kennedy felt comfortable putting U.S. credibility on the line at the height of the Cold War, because in 1962, nearly all the technology that would allow a successful moon landing, the rockets, heat shields, life support systems, and computers making complex mathematical calculations, already existed. He was neither conjuring a far-off future like Jules Verne, nor inventing science fiction. He was drawing very clear inferences from existing technology that only needed some additional tweaks. Nearly everything was in place. The realization was inevitable. Only the timing was at issue. 7 years later, Neil Armstrong climbed down the Apollo 11 ladder in his One Small Step for Man, One Giant Leap for Mankind. For the genetics revolution, now is the equivalent not of 1865, but of 1962. Talk of recasting our species is not speculative science fiction, but the logical near-term extension of fast-growing technologies that already exist. We now have all the tools we need to alter the genetic makeup of our species. The science is in place. The realization is inevitable. The only variables are whether this process will fully take off a couple of decades sooner or later, and what values we will deploy to guide how the technology evolves. Not everyone has heard of Moore's Law, the observation that computer processing power roughly doubles about every 2 years, but we've all internalized its implications. That's why we expect each new version of our iPhones and laptops to be lighter and do more. But it's becoming increasingly clear there is a Moore's Law equivalent for understanding and altering all biology, including our own. We are coming to realize our biology is yet another system of information technology. Our heredity is not magic, we have learned, but code that is increasingly understandable, readable, writable, and hackable. Because of this, we will soon have many of the same expectations for ourselves as we do for our other information technology. We will increasingly see ourselves in many ways as IT. This idea frightens many people, and it should. It should also excite us based on its incredible life-affirming possibilities. Regardless of how we feel, the genetic future will arrive far sooner than we are prepared for, building on technologies that already exist. As a start, we will use the existing technologies of in vitro fertilization, IVF, and informed embryo selection, not just to screen out the simplest genetic diseases and select gender, as is currently the case, but also to choose and then alter the genetics of our future children more broadly. A second overlapping phase of the human genetic revolution will go a step farther, bumping up the number of eggs available for IVF by inducing large numbers of adult cells, like blood or skin cells, into stem cells, turning those stem cells into egg cells, and then growing those egg cells into actual eggs. If and when this process becomes safe for humans, women undergoing IVF will be able to have not just 10 or 15 of their eggs fertilized, but hundreds. Instead of screening the smaller number of their own embryos, these prospective parents would be able to review screens for hundreds or more, supercharging the embryo selection process with big data analytics. Many parents will also consider the possibility of not just selecting, but of genetically altering their future children. Gene editing technologies have been around for years, but the recent development of new tools like CRISPR-Cas9 is making it possible to edit the genes of all species, including ours, with far greater precision, speed, flexibility, and affordability than ever before. With CRISPR and tools like it, it will ultimately be scientifically possible to give embryos new traits and capabilities by inserting DNA from other humans, animals, or someday even synthetic sources. Once parents realize they can use IVF and embryo selection to screen out the risk of many genetic diseases and potentially select for perceived positive traits like higher IQ and even greater extroversion and empathy, more parents will want their children conceived outside the mother. Many will come to see conception through sex as a dangerous and unnecessary risk. Governments and insurance companies will want prospective parents to use IVF and embryo selection to avoid having to pay for lifetimes of care for avoidable and expensive genetic diseases. With whatever mix of catalysts and first movers, it is almost impossible to believe that our species will forego chasing advances in technologies that have the potential to eradicate terrible diseases, improve our health, and increase our lifespans. We have embraced every new technology, from explosives to nuclear energy to anabolic steroids to plastic surgery, that promises to improve our lives despite their potential downsides, and this will be no exception. The very idea of altering our genetics calls for an enormous dose of humility, but we would be a different species if humility, not hubristic aspiration, had been our guiding principle. With these tools, we will want to eliminate genetic diseases in the near term, alter and enhance other capabilities in the medium term, and, perhaps, prepare ourselves to live on a hotter Earth, in space, or on other planets in the longer term. Over time, mastering the tools of genetically manipulating ourselves will come to be seen as perhaps the greatest innovation in the history of our species, the key to unlocking an almost unimaginable potential, and in many ways an entirely new future. But that doesn't make all of this any less jarring. As this revolution unfolds, not everyone will be comfortable with genetic enhancement based on their ideological or religious beliefs, or due to real or perceived safety concerns. Life is not just about science and code. It involves mystery and chance and, for some, spirit. If ours was an ideologically uniform species, this transformation would be challenging. In a world where differences of opinion and belief are so vast and levels of development so disparate, it has the potential, at least if we're not careful, to be cataclysmic. We'll have to ask and answer some truly fundamental questions. Will we use these powerful technologies to expand or limit our humanity? Will the benefits of this science go to the privileged few? Or will we use these advances to reduce suffering, respect diversity, and promote global health and well-being for everyone? Who has the right to make individual or collective decisions that could ultimately impact the entire human gene pool? And what kind of process, if any, do we need to make our best collective decisions possible about our future evolutionary trajectory as one or possibly more than one species? There are no easy answers to any of these questions, but every human being needs to be part of the process of grappling with them. We each must see ourselves as President Kennedy stepping to the podium in 1962 Houston, preparing to give our own speech about the future of our species in light of the genetics and biotechnology revolutions. Our collective responses, laundered by our conversations, organizations, civil movements, political structures, and global institutions, will determine in many ways who we are, what we value, and how we move forward. But to be part of that process, we all have an urgent need to educate ourselves on the issues. "Mr. Metzl, we are ready for you," the receptionist called. I shook my head slightly and looked up, still feeling a little nervous. As the door opened to the back corridor, I stood slowly, paused a moment, then took a deliberate first step forward. I've written this book to lay out my case for why, even though the human genetic revolution is inevitable and approaching quickly, how this revolution plays out is anything but inevitable and is, in important ways, up to us. To make the smartest collective decisions about our way forward, we'll need to understand what's happening and what's at stake and bring as many of us as possible into the conversation. This book is my humble effort to jumpstart that process. The door is open for all of us. Whether we like it or not, we are all marching toward it. Our future awaits.